My name is Roy Malloy, and you are listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast dedicated to the fascinating bits and pieces that made us who we are through the people that skirted around the grey area of the law. Today I'm talking with one of the people that I love and admire most in the entire world. She's a woman who has for the sake of her dignity, a very long, but I won't name the years, a very long history working in Christian ministries around the world, but with some of the most marginalized people. And therein we find that inextricable link to the poverty that brings about criminality. In her life, she began as a Salvation Army officer's daughter on missionary fields in the West, came to Melbourne in the late 40s and early 50s, and then herself found a calling into Christian ministries with the Salvation Army. I'll be introducing Jennifer Darlow, who will be talking a little bit about her work that spanned several continents, but saw some of the most incredible sights that you could ever imagine. Thanks for joining us, Jen.
You're welcome. I'm enjoying this already.
I can give you a grander introduction if you'd like. We could play Trump.
Oh, no, that'll do.
The trumpets are very befitting the Salvation Army introduction. The Salvos in Australia are part of your work, but then also in Baptist ministries and now contemporary ministries in your flourishing. I'm trying to be nice how I say this, because also I've got to be aware that Jen is one of the few people that can still clap me around the back of the ear hole, because she's my own beautiful mother. So I've got to be cautious of the words that I say. But in her life, Jen, my mum, Jen, has done so many incredible things and is now still active at the sprightly age of, I'm going to say, 94. No, I'm kidding. But you look great for 94 if you weren't. She's not. She's in her early 70s. Now, if you can talk us through, let's start from the beginning, which is where a good story begins. You were born into what kind of family?
I was the youngest of six children. One of them was stillborn. And my parents were sort of mid-level Salvation Army officers running all the youth work in Perth at the time of my birth.
Okay, so that means that your parents were also then involved with a lot of foster kids, children who were orphans legitimately, and that would be...
No, not together like that. My mother had actually worked in a girls' home before she married my father, because the Salvation Army catered for a lot of children's homes and young women's hostels when they came from the country to the city to get work.
Now, there's two kinds of women's hostels in that catch-all, isn't there? There's certainly the very Victorian-era-style, respectable place where a young lady could come from the country, be supervised by a caring and Christian matron to make sure that this is a single woman living by herself, but it's all above board. And then there's the other,
yes,
which are women who have befallen really extraordinarily difficult times at a time when social welfare by the government was really inadequate, and they needed that opportunity to help them get set up in a respectable way.
Well, of course, there was a great stigma in those days to unmarried mothers. And actually in Perth, there was a home hospital called Hillcrest for unmarried mothers to allow girls to go there, live there, have their babies, have them adopted, and then go home as if nothing had happened. And in actual fact, that's where I was born, not because my mother was a single mum, but because she was an officer and the Salvation Army owned the place. It was cheaper for us to go, or officers to have their babies there. And so I was actually born at Hillcrest Home for Unmarried Mothers.
That's extraordinary. So then at what age did you come to Victoria?
Just after my second birthday, I think it was.
Okay. And the people that you grew up around, the men and women who were the colleagues of your parents, who were also the leaders of your social experience in church and social life, by and large, the officers and soldiers had lived through World War II.
Yes.
Made of a pretty solid kind of steel, weren't they?
Oh, they were fine men. Absolutely fine, solid men filled with integrity.
And we're talking Red Shield. Now, the Red Shield is a regiment within the Salvation Army, originally designed to be the chaplains in the face of war.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about your own family's inheritance of this.
Well, my dad went off to the war. He went to New Guinea and he was a chaplain up in Darwin and across to New Guinea and supervised, actually, the work that the Salvation Army was doing with the soldiers at that time.
Okay. And you came to Melbourne. That would place you in Melbourne in the mid to late 1940s. What do you want? Collections of Melbourne?
Well, I have a few recollections, even at that young age, of the trip over, which is a very interesting story, because being in the Salvation Army, they did not pay for anything other than second class in transport, because they carried all our finances or our expenses. So we had seven of our own family, five children. And then we also had another lady that lived with us for more 20 years. She was at that time a sort of a fairly young woman, probably in her 20s, and she had come to live with us to help Mum because Mum was working as an officer as well. So we had the eight of us, and we had second-class sleepers across the desert, and then we had second-class sitting up from Adelaide through to Melbourne. And I remember having to stop because it was a steam train. And so we stopped every so often to refuel the train. And I still have this image of it looked so barren and dead. And then as we pulled in, out of nowhere it appeared that there were some Aboriginal families that would just magically seem to appear by the train. And we would swap them for their artefacts. We would swap them tomatoes or, you know, fresh fruit, and that's how they got their nourishment in that way. And we still have in our family to this day some beautiful, genuine Aboriginal artefacts that were swapped at that time. So we came to live in Northcote, which is an inner Melbourne suburb.
What was Northcote like in that day? What are your recollections of Northcote? I mean, you're still very young at this point.
Yes, I was. Look, again, Dad had an office job because he was in administration. Mum used to go out all the time helping Dad. She was a secretary, and she was really and truly an officer first and then a mother second, because she had Lil to look after us. And so we lived in this very modest house in Separation Street in Northcote. And our lives revolved around the Salvation Army and its activities. Two things that stand out, or three things in my mind from Northcote. One was that I fell into the fish pond in the house next door and I could have drowned but didn't. Another one was that I ran across Separation Street and was hit by a car and was not hurt, but by gee, I got into trouble for that. And then I've got a brother who's 17 months older than me, and one day we decided we'd go to work with Dad, but we forgot to tell him. And so we climbed into the back of his station wagon, and we got halfway there, and then I panicked because I thought we were certainly going to get into trouble for this one. So we made ourselves known, and Dad very graciously took us home with a tongue lashing, but nothing more. And that's about the extent. And, of course, the Salvation Army meetings, which were my way of life. Meetings are like church services, but they happened very regularly in my life.
And that kind of leads us to then your own decision and calling to enter a lifestyle which involves working with some of the most destitute people in the world at that time.
I hate to say it didn't come quite that early. We had a trip up to Bendigo. We had 3 years in Bendigo, where my father was a divisional commander. Again, he was an officer before a parent, and so they were away a fair bit. And Bendigo was an interesting place for us to live. And then we came back to Melbourne to Camberwell, and it was at Camberwell that Can I just tell you what my life consisted of with the Salvation Army, and you'll understand more about what I'm, you know, about my life. Sundays we would have a round the table breakfast, eggs and bacon Sunday mornings. At the end of the breakfast, we'd all hit the floor on our knees and Dad would pray for a very long time. And then we'd finish that segment with the Lord's Prayer, oh, you know, Our Father. And then I would go to Sunday school at 9:30 and then church service at 11 and then Sunday school at 2:30 and then we'd go to the outside service, the roundabout. We'd stand around in the streets singing and playing tambourines and everything. We called that the open air meeting, and then a fine march back to the hall. I loved those marches. And then the 7 o'clock church service, and frequently an 8:30 celebration or an after church service. And that was just Sunday. And then we had Tuesday night tambourine practice and Wednesday night choir or songster practice, Thursday night Bible study, Friday night youth group. And so my whole life was enveloped in the Salvation Army.
It's pretty all-encompassing, isn't it? In your...
Yeah.
Now, the open-air church services and the marching bands of the Salvation Army's history that no longer really happen, but they were a rife part of Australian culture all the way up into the early 1980s. They were a moment where the Salvation Army would mobilise out into the suburbs with a marching band.
Yes.
6 to 20 people, depending on the size of the group, and then behind them.
Yes.
And that was men. Men were in the band, and then women were.
Yes.
A uniform of their own, marching side by side like a military, playing a like a tambourine but with a skin and bells and ribbons called a timbrel. Did you ever see? There's a lot of history about these kinds of marching processions being assaulted by the public in every country that it's ever happened. Did you ever experience any of that opposition from the locals?
Not in Camberwell, where I was at the time, because Camberwell was very subdued and very, well, middle class. But when I, a bit later on, when I was training to be an officer, we were doing an open air meeting down in near some big public flats, and I was hit on the head, on the bonnet, actually. We used to wear old-fashioned straw bonnets, and I was hit with a tomato. We did have a bit of opposition, but really and truly the army, because of the war, had built up such an amazing reputation that they, we were almost revered by most of the public.
So then the opportunity to...
Sorry.
Yeah, please.
Go on. Sorry.
After you.
Well, I was just going to go back to the question you asked me about when my life changed, and it was at Camberwell. And we had, at the end of every service, they had what they called an appeal, and we were offered a chance, everybody was, to give their hearts to the Lord, to repent of their sin, and come out the front of the service and kneel at the penitent form and give your heart to God. And I was sitting in one of these prayer meetings at the end of a service, and it was a most extraordinary thing. I was 9, and it was, I could not have sat in my chair if I'd tried, and I found myself kneeling at the penitent form, and I spoke to a lady and said I wanted to say sorry to God for my sin and ask him to come and live in my life. And it was a physical experience, but I can't describe it. But I knew from that moment on that my life was not my own. I had given my heart to Jesus, and I was going to be working for him in some form or other for the rest of my life. I was his and he was mine.
Okay. That's incredibly moving. So then when you had made this decision and you became a young adult, your vocation was then almost sorted. It was ready to go. You had a very clear path as to what you'd do, and I'm guessing the Salvation Army fostered all the directions you needed to travel in professionally. What does it take to become a Salvation Army, or did it take then to become a Salvation Army officer?
Well, really, it wasn't any educational standards. They really encouraged you to be, you know, educationally proficient, But basically, it was on your testimony that the Holy Spirit had called you to become a Salvation Army officer. And I always knew that I was called to be in service for God, but because the Salvation Army was the only world I knew, there was no thought that it could be, this calling could be worked out as a nurse or a policeman or anything else. It was just I had to be a Salvation Army officer. So I applied and had a couple of interviews and convinced them that God had called me to be an officer. And they accepted me. And so my husband and I had married a man who also was a Salvation Army officer's son. And together we applied and were accepted to train for 2 years at the Salvation Army Training College. And I just want to highlight the fact that it is not a biblical, wasn't then a biblical college or a Bible college. It was a training college. So you'll notice that, or in those days, the Salvation Army, we preached, we did all the things that regular ministers did, but there was a lot more that we were expected to do because we were the Salvation Army. And so we were trained in all round serving the public.
So that would be more along the lines of a social work kind of existence with outreach Christian ministry, I guess.
Yes, it was you're right, a combination of social work and ministry all wrapped up in one.
Okay. So then you were living, where were you living when you did the, where was the training done and where were you living?
We did the first year, we lived on the corner, there's a row of terrace houses on the corner of Gertrude and Nicholson Street in Fitzroy, and they were gifted to the Salvation Army. And so all the married couples with children, or yes, with or without children, all the married couples lived in those terrace houses. There were three families in the one that we lived in, and we walked down to Victoria Parade, and the Salvation Army Training College was just across the road. So that was our journey every day. We'd live at the annex and go down to train. And then we had 1 year of training, and then we were sent out for 12 weeks out training, practical training. And my husband and I were sent to Collingwood Corps. But because there was a shortage of officers, and because we were so excited about the whole prospect of being in ministry, we were offered the chance to stay at Collingwood for the second year of our training, doing full-time training and running the Corps at the same time. And we eagerly jumped at that. And we had the most wonderful 12 months there.
Sounds nice to live on the corner of Gertrude Street in Fitzroy now. It wasn't...
It was pretty seedy then.
Well, now it's beautiful. That's a VIP suburb now. But back...
Oh, right.
Yeah. Well, back then it was just on the back end of the reign of some of the most notorious gangsters and criminals Australia's ever seen.
Yeah, well, it was pretty seedy, I can tell you.
Well, then leads us to Collingwood, because Collingwood wasn't much better, was it?
Which wasn't?
Collingwood in the 1970s.
Collingwood. Look, I loved Collingwood and I only saw what was good in Collingwood. But, yes, it had a certain element. For instance, our little church, or core as we called it, was on the corner of Mater and Wellington Street, and it was only a little hall. And I remember going there for our welcome meeting, and there was probably a dozen people. And a person welcomed us, and that person was, I don't know if I want to label somebody, but she stood up and said in her best language, "Well, we heard yous were coming. And we're not real pleased about it because we've heard that yous are snobs." And we were a bit shocked at that because it hadn't occurred to us that maybe we were snobs, and maybe we were. But I can tell you that that woman taught us such a lot, and we had the most wonderful time. And God showed us so much, so many truths, and rewarded us. We said to him that we wanted, by the end of the 12 months, we wanted to have 100 people in the church. And by the end of the 12 months, he had rallied around, and we had about 80 to 90 people coming regularly every Sunday night for a wonderful service.
Extraordinary. And so then in that time, that's the infancy of your career. Then with a small family, you were offered an overseas post. Talk us through what that means and how you get that kind of... the delivery of that news that you'll be taking on a big challenge in the country.
Well, I had grown up thinking I was going to be an army officer, and I always added on that I thought I'd go as a missionary to Africa, and I thought all the demons were in Africa in the black people. That shows how much training and understanding I had really of what it's all about.
And just to clarify, this doesn't reflect on your present day view. It reflects on
an ignorance of all things as a child and growing up.
Really clear, this isn't a view that is held by this lovely lady in this present day. It's a
no, not at all. I cringe as I say that, because that was my very naive understanding.
People to rip down statues as a result of your comments.
Sorry?
I would hate for people to go ripping down statues as a result of your presence.
Oh, no, not at all. Honestly, that was my very immature, untaught view of the world, because I had such a narrow view. And I suppose in a way it reflected the view of young people in the 70s, in the 60s and 50s. And we had a lot of learning and growing up to do. And so I had this passion that I was going to go to Africa, and I was going to teach the people of the world all about Jesus. But my fear was, as a child and a young teenager, that Jesus was so wonderful that by the time I grew up old enough to go and see them, they'd all know about him anyway, and there would be nothing for me to do. and so I had a lot of learning to do. Anyway, we had been officers for about, 6-7 years, and my husband had actually gone and become a social worker, because the government at that time had requested that all organisations had to have X number of professional social workers working for them. And so John was able to train as a social worker. And we got a call from the commissioner to say that there had been a plea for a social worker to go to Hong Kong, because it was just after the Vietnam War, and all the Vietnamese refugees were flooding into all parts of the world, including Hong Kong, and they didn't have the facilities or the know-how to deal with it. And so with me being pregnant with my fourth child, we packed up, and in 6 weeks, we just got a call to say, well, you're going to Hong Kong, be ready to go in 6 weeks. And so we packed up, said quick farewell, and we went to Hong Kong. And at that stage, I had never been out of Australia except for 1 week in New Zealand, whereas my husband was actually born of missionary parents and lived in India and Sri Lanka until he was 14. So he had a much wider world view than I did.
Okay. So then what age did you hit Hong Kong?
I wish you hadn't asked me that. But we move right along. I can't remember.
You would have been in your early 30s, I'm guessing, with three
children. Well, I can work it out, but it'll take me a bit of time. I was probably 30. 31 or 2.
Okay. So in a state of wonder, arrive in Hong Kong, then you're given residence, certainly. Your accommodation is taken care of by the Salvation Army. You're put in what's called a quarters. Being the Salvation
yes.
Army, a military-themed Christian organisation, the barracks-style living with its own apartment. What was the work that you undertook?
Well, John was busy going out to Lantau Island and setting up refugee camps, which is another whole story, which maybe you'd be interested in for another day. And I had my last son, Richard, at the Adventist Hospital. And when I was having him, we got a call from the Kiwanis group of people who are like Rotary. And they had been sponsoring some work the Salvation Army were doing in a place called the Kowloon Walled City. And they needed a coordinator between the Salvation Army and the Kiwanis and asked me if I would do that. And so I blithely said yes, without really considering anything, because God had called me to do it.
Okay. In the time that you were there, you undertook one of the biggest ministries that you've ever been involved in. And it was work with a group of people that are unique globally. They were an unclaimed people by any nation, living in a complete state of lawlessness. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, the Kowloon Walled City was when England signed a lease with China, there was one family that didn't want to be part of the signing. So they said, well, we're not going to be part of this. We're going to have our own little place and administer ourselves. China said, well, that's fine because we don't want to have one family to look after in Hong Kong. And England said, well, we don't really, you know, consider that to be our responsibility. And so this family built a wall around it, and the area was a quarter of a square mile, and I'm not sure what that is in metric system. So then people came to live there if they were running away from the law. And it grew and grew, and then the Japanese came during the war and they took the wall that was around the Kowloon Walled City and they built the Kai Tak runway with it. But still the boundary was there, and it became a place where anyone that had no legality could go and live there safely. So in our day, when we were there, the police and the military were not allowed in. It was off limits to anyone from England, and the Chinese people didn't bother about it at all. So in any situation like that, you get people who want to rule. And so the triads moved in. And they were basically, when you say it was lawless, it was full of people who disregarded the law. However, there was a very strict law within the Kowloon Walled City because the triads ran it. And the triads are a bit like the mafia of Italy, I suppose. But people who were qualified in whatever fashion in, say, China, if they escaped from the communistic rule and got to Hong Kong, they didn't have an ID card, so they couldn't work, so they would go and work in the Kowloon Walled City. And so there were lots of illegal dentists and factories, little factories that saw, you know, like 3 metres square, and they'd be pumping out fish balls or dim sum or watch bands, and children would be operating the machines, and there was no electricity and no water installed. But that didn't stop them because they just hooked their own up from outside the walled city. And so the streets in the walled city were about 5 feet wide and cobblestones and down under the ground. So you couldn't see light And you couldn't hear planes going over, even though the Kaitiak runway was less than a kilometre from where we were. And because all the electricity and the water had been hooked up by amateurs, you know, they weren't very safe. And they had nowhere to put their rubbish, so they'd just put their rubbish outside the door. And there would be, when I said there was an organisation, people would be assigned to pick up the rubbish once or twice a week and take it outside the walled city, and then the Kowloon government would pick it up from outside. And then lastly, there was no running sewerage, and so people just had a hole in the wall with a pipe, and they'd straddle over a trough, and their excrement would go outside and fall into the open sewers, which were about a foot wide. And so that would attract lots of vermin.
Being that Hong Kong is in a subtropical climate, it's also subject to monsoons and heavy rains. And I mean, with no sewerage that pumps to a collective pool like a proper sewer does, that would have been subject, and you're underground with no pump out. Talk about, there must have been floodings as well. I'm just unpacking this logically.
Yes, every so often they'd flood, and we'd have to put little primary chairs on the path and walk on the chairs so that we didn't fall into the sewer.
So that's your average day at work, is stepping across small plastic chairs in a street.
Not average, but it would happen frequently, put it that way.
Well, it's never happened to me. So I'm going to say that's those of you joining us at home, put your hand up if you've ever had to step across a makeshift pontoon bridge of plastic stacking chairs that help you across a flowing river of human excrement and grey water. The work that you were doing in this incredible landscape, and I should say, anybody listening, do Google the Kowloon Walled City. I have, and I'm shocked how little internet content exists about it. Some of the internet content that is coming out at the moment is being generated by people about my age. I'm 45, and there are people my age who are now saying, well, I actually am a successful Chinese citizen of Hong Kong, and I begun my life at the Walled City. And so these people have access to the internet, just maybe no longer with the Chinese government taking over Hong Kong. But we're not really seeing a lot. So I'm thrilled to be able to add some content from a primary source to what we understand the Kowloon Walled City as. Your job inside the Kowloon Walled City, can you talk to us specifically about where in the actual complex it was? The top floor, the ground floor, the middle, the outside, and what the job was?
We had a two-story building, and I couldn't exactly tell you where it was. It was well in the bowels of the place, and it had a toilet on the first floor with the system, as I told you. We had 110 children over two sessions a day, and they started at age two, and they all came in beautifully clean, crisp little uniforms, and they sat at their desks. And the pressure was that these children, if we didn't do this and other organisations like the Salvation Army, they wouldn't get an education, and that would cruel them for the rest of their lives. So they had to start at age two, and before they were five, they had to learn to read and write between 2,000 and 3,000 Chinese characters. And they had homework they do from 8:30 till 12, and then they would take homework home. And if ever I cut it back because I thought they should be playing sand and water and blocks, the parents would get very angry and say, no, if they don't keep up their work, they will never get into a school if ever we get out of the walled city.
So, stark reminder for everybody living in the first world, isn't it? Just how
it is.
So these these children are then, as I have several of my own children, and the youngest is four, about to turn five, So this is really in that age bracket. She wakes up and she paints a picture. I'm homeschooling her during lockdown, and we do a little bit of maths, and we write a couple of letters, and we have a letter of the day. But she then plays outside in the sand, and she plays on the grass. She has, we've got a little, you know, a little rocking horse in the backyard. It's so starkly different from the experience of these children living in completely restricted, I don't even know how to describe the walled city. Can you talk a little bit more about the experience of these children coming in contact with your work?
All right. Well, the Kowloon Walled City at the time I was there had 35,000 people living in it. Now go back to that quarter of a square mile, 35,000 people. So as people came, they would just build another room on top of another room on top of another room. And some of the children had never seen daylight. You couldn't see daylight from our kindergarten. It was just black. And so some of them would never have been outside, because it was known at some stages that if a child was taken outside and they were accosted by the police, the child was allowed to stay in Hong Kong because they'd been born there, but the parents would have to go to China. It would be sent back to China, and they would separate them. And so there was fear all the time. So some of these kids had no idea of a life outside of the walled city.
I'll read you some stats on Google to give you a bit more impact. Now, these statistics are from 1990. This is a government statistic, and it was the walled city itself was 2.4 hectares. It had a total in 1990 of 50,000 people living in it, which is beyond imagining. And so then with these children, who some of them have grown up to become quite successful adults, which is mind-blowing. What was your experience with their, with the longevity of this career of yours and the journey you had with these children?
Well, I'm really glad to hear that, because we only dealt with the little children, and we tried to introduce them to a normal life. I remember once a year we were allowed to take a group of them out for Christmas. And the first year, in our naivety, we decided we'd take them across the bay to Ocean Park. That was our first mistake, because many of them had never even seen the water, let alone been on it, and there was much seasickness. We then gave them McDonald's because we thought they'd enjoy that, and that it contributed to the seasickness. Then we took them up to the Ocean Park, and there were all these playground equipment there, and they stood and looked because they didn't know what it was. And so we had to get on the swings and the slides and show them before they understood. So the idea was that when the children had finished the kindergarten course at age 5 or 6, they had to sit an entrance exam. And depending on their scores, they were allowed to go out of the walled city under government supervision to go to a primary school. And so it depended on what their score was as to which primary school they went to. And there were some very bright children, very conscientious children. And so I know that there would be people who have excelled and began their lives in the walled city.
Now, these are children also you mentioned who are raised by parents who are either peripherally or directly involved in the Chinese Triad, which again, as you referenced, then and now were an active organisation who resemble very closely the Sicilian and Calabrian mafia. Did you ever have any direct experience with them?
Look, to be honest, I knew that they ran the place, and I knew that our kindergarten paid a monthly, it wasn't a ransom, a monthly fee to enable us to keep running. That went via, it was all very secretive, and one particular lady was chosen to deliver the money.
How much was it?
I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you. It was all very secretive, but it was real.
Okay.
There's a very good book called Chasing the Dragon, written by Jackie Pullinger, who was also in the Kowloon Walled City as a missionary, and she lived and worked there. Her experiences and mine correspond in some respects, but it also gives you another view of the Kowloon Walled City.
Okay. And you found that, did you have any opposition from anybody in the Walled City for the work you were doing? Because it's a stark shift in culture from its origins.
Yeah. Look, I never did. Only one day I felt very distinctly uneasy, and I felt like God was saying, don't stay today, please go home. And I did.
I just will pause. That's okay. We did. The audio froze. That's not you at home doing anything wrong, guys. Just to keep talking while I'm on. We're just waiting for you to catch up. It's gotten a bit glitchy, and I think Jen might be tethering via Zoom on her phone.
Sorry,
phone just rang. That's the one. Now we'll wait till we catch up with you, Jen. But isn't lockdown fascinating that we're all trying to evolve with mechanisms like Zoom? And I will be honest, I've had to beg and plead with my children, who are the next generation. They find accessing Zoom effortless, and they laugh at me for my complete ignorance to online things, and they're right to laugh at me, because if it was reversed, I remember laughing at my dad because he thought an Atari XE was unbelievable. Now I think we've got you back in the room, Jen, and you begun to say that her experience paralleled yours, and then we kind of lost you.
Oh, right. Yes, look, she was a wonderful woman, and her work was different. She worked with drug addicts, and there were many of those, because it was full of, I forgot to say that there were many, many opium dens within the Walled City, and also prostitution
What
rings.
Does an opium den look like?
I never saw one.
You kept well.
They were. Oh, that's what I started to say. Keep in mind that we wore uniforms, and so we stood out like sore thumbs. And I used to say hello to everybody on the way in, because it was so dense, and it was very easy to get lost. And I used to think, if ever I disappeared in there, and there was one of these apocryphal stories that someone went in and never came out again, I could believe that actually. But I was always a little bit nervous, and I'd say hello to everybody and smile in the hope that if ever I disappeared, somebody at least would remember that I'd walked in there.
Extraordinary health and safety issue right there. I also remember you had tours that went through the Walled City.
Well, yes, we had to fund the place on our own. We had to fund it, and the Kiwanis were wonderful, and they had a worldwide
The Kiwanis are like a Rotary, and they specialise in the welfare of children globally.
Yes, a wonderful, wonderful men. And so I had to organise the sponsorship program. And, of course, there was a lot of money in Hong Kong and a lot of wives of expats that were bored witless, and so they used to like to do charity work. And so we would get, for instance, I'd get a call from the Australian club to say, look, we've got some money that we've raised, can you use it, and can you show us what you would use it for? And of course that was gold to my ears. And so I remember one particular day I said, yes, look, I will take a couple of you in there to show you what we do. I turned up and there were 35 women, because really it was known in certain circles, but you couldn't get in unless you knew someone. And if you could imagine.
And these are women these are women who are the wives of CEOs. And Hong Kong in the 1980s, 70s and 80s was like Dubai in the early 2000s.
Oh, yes, easily.
Financial So these women they're socialites in the last dying days where there were socialites.
Oh, yes, yes. And so we had 35 women in this particular group, all with their designer dresses and their Gucci shoes, etc. And I must be honest, we developed a system where we could extract as much finance as we could from these people because we needed it. And I remember walking along and saying, now let me just count you before you go in because we don't want to lose anybody. And that would put the scare up to them. And then just before they'd go in, I'd say, now, look, just one more thing. If a rat comes at you, kick it before it bites you. And they would have fear dripping from them. And this particular day, I was at the back of the queue and our driver headed off and he got lost. And so we were in a dead end, dark, and 35 women nervous. And suddenly a great big rat ran out and ran across one of the women's feet and she screamed. And we had a pile of women all running up and down on the spot, wanting to run somewhere, and there was nowhere to run. And I was almost paralytic with laughter at the back of the queue. And we finally got into the kindergarten and they were so relieved that they gave us very generously just to get out.
So, listening in on this, also get on Google and Google what a Manila rat is, because we're not talking the Australian variety. I have an interest in a business along Flinders Street and it's right next to the Yarra River. So naturally we get a lot of river rats coming up and they're about the size of my forearm. Manila rats can grow anything up to the size of my torso and weigh close to 10 kilograms. They are an extraordinary beast and they thrive in sewage. Your work brought you through that incredible experience. I recall a story you mentioned of a landlord who was tried objecting to your choice of pictures on the wall and removing them. You had a picture of Jesus on the wall that he objected to and removed.
Yes, well, you know, it was a school, a government not funded, but a government accredited kindergarten. And so we used to observe Christmas, had all the children dressed up as, you know, Chinese Mary and Chinese Jesus and Chinese angels. Beautiful. We taught the story of Christ. And we did have, well, we used the place on Sunday for worship anyway. And there was, again, I think it was Triad run, a bit of a raid, and they objected to the heavy presence of Jesus and asked us to remove them. But we didn't, because we felt that, you know, we were there for a purpose to not only educate but to introduce the idea of Christian living and redemption.
Quite extraordinary. Your experience was from 1979 to 1985.
Yes.
And you came back from there, handing the torch on to then further generations of Salvation Army to take over. Of your time as a Salvation Army officer, do you have any one or more, but a most profound experience that you felt really touched on the most meaningful singular event of your career?
Yes, I guess when I came back to I'm not quite sure what you're asking me here, I have to be honest.
Career highlight.
Because God was so real to me and saved us from so many things that I guess in Hong Kong particularly, the time when we were robbed by Chinese Red Guards was the most profound thing for us. And it was very dramatic, but the lessons that we learned from it, and the most important was that there is a God, that he does protect and that he does heal and enable us to do what he's called us to do, if we let him deal with people who perpetrate against us.
That is stunningly pacifistic. And I mean stunningly in its correct use of the word. Thank you so much for
coming. Well, I'd like to expand on that, but really we haven't got time now, but maybe another time if... Pardon?
Oh, no, I'm just appreciating what you're saying. And so thank you.
Because there were some very real lessons that I learned in that. And once you go through an experience as we did like that, you never, ever doubt God. And he is so real that it just changes your life.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you. This has been The Dawn of Crime. You've been listening to Australian Mission Minister, Evangelist and Witness, Jennifer Darlow. It's been a thrill having you guys. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast. And remember to hit like on whatever server provider you are listening to this on.